First of all, I would like to thank the organizers of this conference for the opportunity to be here, and I'm very pleased to have the chance to present some of the results of our work at Bir Umm Fawa here in the central eastern desert of Egypt. In brief, the Bir Umm Fawa here project, of the Oriel Institute of the University of Chicago spent four seasons of survey and one of excavation. We started in 1992 at the far southeastern end of the site and mapped our way northwest in 1993, 1996, and made a big push in 1997 to complete the map of the entire main settlement. It's about a half a kilometer from one end to the other. 1999 was our only chance to excavate, and we only excavated three out of 237 buildings, a very small sample indeed. In addition to mapping the main settlement shown in blue here, we carried out some walking surveys and identified 14 outlying clusters of ruins of the same date, shown in red. In the 5th and 6th centuries, the Byzantine Empire had a staggering need for gold, for armies, navies, diplomatic efforts, a vast building program, and the glittering court at Constantinople itself. Unfortunately, some of the old gold sources had been lost to enemies or worked out, so new tactics had, in some cases, to be tried. And we're pretty sure that the work at Bir Umm Fawa here was a government operation. Nobody else had the capital to launch this project or to call up so many workers and supply and organize them. So when the workers set out from the Nile, they were heading into the deep desert, but they were not heading into unknown territory. The Presidia along the Wadi Hammamat route still existed, and one or two of them were occupied in the Byzantine period. And the miners were heading into a known gold mining zone. This area, a little bit to the south in the Wadi Asid, had been worked for gold since at least the New Kingdom period, as attested by the Turin gold mining papyrus, a handful of New Kingdom pottery, and other bits and pieces. However, in the Byzantine period, they did not work down here, but a little bit further north at Bir Umm Fawa here, possibly because these mines had been worked out by ancient techniques. I'm not going into the geology, fascinating as it is, except to say that gold here occurs in quartz veins in granite. Specifically, this pinkish Fawa here granite injected, this is Precambrian rock, injected into even older Precambrian ultramafics to the west. The other great resource is the wells at Bir Umm Fawa here, and this is abundant and sweet water, unlike so many of the brackish wells in the desert. When the miners arrived at Bir Umm Fawa here, they found earlier remains, Ptolemaic and Roman. If there was a presidium like the other ones on the road down by the wells, then it is the most thoroughly destroyed of all the presidia. If it existed, it would have been subject to flash floods coming through, and then this entire area was clawed up in the early 20th century and fed into the ore-crushing mills for gold. So what we have is just bits and pieces. There's a remnant of the Ptolemy III temple, some Roman graffiti in the cave behind the modern town, bits and pieces collected by miners over the decades. There's some Roman quarrying works, especially this one back here with quarry slots like those at Mons Claudianus and elsewhere, but really just bits and pieces. So when the miners arrived, they very promptly started setting about building housing in this long, deep side wadding. The basic unit is a 2 or 3 room house, dry stone masonry, skillfully laid, nice doors, niches, benches, no cut stone, no plastering. This one probably survives to its original height, about this. Then you allow for windblown sand and steps down into it, but it's still probably with a low roof, probably just covered with branches, twigs, mats, held down with stones. This informal architecture could be expanded by enclosing space in between two houses until you had 5 or 6 houses stuck together into room, agglomerated units of 20 or so rooms. This shows you part of the site with your basic 2 and 3 unit houses in orange, the larger agglomerated units in blue, and these gray areas are shared plazas. The doors open onto these plazas and not out onto the Wadi Street, which suggests that these houses coordinated their activities more easily than not. Kin groups, probably. We don't see what other organization there could be. Fathers, sons, brothers, uncles, and cousins. Women, as in wives and mothers, we have no proof one way or the other. They were probably there, but cross-culturally speaking, women are in short supply in mining camps. The newer the camp, the fewer the women. Prostitutes, definitely possible, well attested in the Roman period, but not part of a stable kin group. The green buildings are little one-room outbuildings, probably for storage animals, warehouses, but not for kitchens. Excavations on either side of Building 93 turned up a couple of outdoor kitchens. So with this, we have an estimate of a little bit over 1,000 for the main settlement alone. This surely fluctuated, but at times it might have been even more people, because outliers 2, 1, and 6 at least look residential and not outlying huts serving the outlying mines. So what we have here is a remarkably complete settlement in some respects. The whole town, house for house, wells, the Roman road, guard posts, cemeteries, mine works. What we do not have is also interesting. There is no walls anywhere to keep anybody in and out, just some guard posts high on the ridges. No administrative buildings, no warehouses, no fancy buildings at all, with the possible exception of this heavy wall building way back in Outlier 6. We have no churches, although the little Ptolemy III temple did exist until the early 20th century. Diodorus Siculus calls the Egyptian workers criminals, captives, people who angered the king, who were worked to death in the greatest of misery. We have no evidence for forced labor at this site. Limited as our excavations were, these silos look like grain rations paid out of salary. We have small personal ornaments like this bessamine, beads, an agate gem, raw emeralds, a bronze weight, half of a copper gold bracelet, some very tiny little coins. Oddly enough, we don't know what religion they adhered to. On the one hand, the Ptolemy III temple was still standing, and we have the little bessamine, very personal. We also have a lot of Coptic symbols stamped on the fancy pottery, Cairo dates on the wine jars, although this pertains to the place where the wine was bottled, and some very ambivalent things like this bird stamp. Religion matters. It determines your work week, your festival cycle, Isis or Christ. And miners are not famously pious, but they are engaged in a dangerous profession, and the only protection is your own skill and a divine intervention. So in addition to being free labor, they seem to have been quite well supplied. Pottery at this site is so dense that the name translates as well of the mother of pots. Wine was in very good supply, judging from all the amphorae. Among the varieties of cooking and working vessels, we have a series of deep bowls or craters, a series of little cups, some of them presumably for drinking, an iron ladle, and we daringly suggest that these were used to gather wine and water, were mixed, ladled out into cups, and at times drunk in a more or less civilized manner. Bones, the sheep and goat bones, are no particular surprise. The amount of cattle bone is. Beef is a very great luxury in the desert where there's no fodder. And I should perhaps modify the seashell comment to say in divination. But in any case, these seashells are the only contact this site has with the marine sources of the Red Sea. Another surprise was what we call the cheese factory on the lowest level of Dump 1, a largemouth pot, possibly for milk, a taller one with holes punched in the bottom for draining out whey. Cheese is a very good solution to the problem of keeping milk in a very hot desert. No surprises in the list of seeds. There was a small sample, probably sampling error, except for the fact that wheat grains were uncommon, or maybe that's not so surprising. On the one hand, these dolia, or pottery storage bins and silos, look like grain storage. This little hearth, clay-sided hearth, packed with dung and fine dung ash, doesn't look big enough to cook bread, so maybe there was a community oven somewhere else. And maybe at times bread was shipped in, like this stuff produced in industrial quantities at Caranus. We can also say a good deal about the mining operations at the site. And the hills around are riddled and trenched with mines. At this point, I have to emphasize that this is hard rock mining, quartz in granite. Panning out alluvial gold from a stream is something one person can do with unskilled labor. Hacking quartz out of granite requires a large, organized labor body. They might be well paid, but they'll never strike it rich. So what you're looking for is quartz like this, stained with hematite or other metallic minerals. The thing to note about this list of glittering metallic minerals is that they're all sulfides, and sulfur ores are much harder to smelt than oxides. There are two basic kinds of mines at the site. There's your open cast trench just cut down from the surface to reach the quartz veins. We have very few mining tools, just this iron wedge or pick. But in some cases, the mines go deeper into the mountainside. In all cases, they can say that they are ancient by the huts and the pottery around them and the dry stone walls at the mouth of this deep mine. In this case, you can see how the trench just sliced down the mountain. This pale stuff is quartz that's just been thrown aside. Up about here, we found this flat stone surrounded by chunks of quartz. So it looks as if the worker sat here, chunked off the ore mined in darkness and picked out the pieces worth the extra effort of grinding and threw the rest down slope. The first step in ore reduction is crushing it down. You put your chunk on a flattish stone, something like this, and take one of these dimpled chunking, crushing stones, grind it down, pound it around, grind it down, pound it around, until you beat the ore down to the size of a pea or a lentil. When this dimple gets too deep, you throw it away and get another one. We have so many things, many of these things, that they were reused in steps leading up to this house and to the slope behind. The next stage is to throw that crushed ore into a rotary grinding stone. Here's your lower stone, your upper stone with a spoke hole. Diodorus says that women working in pairs ground this ore. Possible, we don't know. And the next stage was washing it, maybe an inclined table like this, maybe another method. And we ran a couple of replications experiments at the site. This is Mr. Earle, a British mining engineer, and he demonstrated that you have to crush this ore to face powder to get any gold out of it at all. And then he washed it out on his special vanning shovel. What you get is not visible gold. You get a dark, heavy, sparkly residue of these heavy metallic minerals. And I think this is as far as the processing went at Virumfawa here. We looked for slags, we didn't find any. It's a very fuel-intensive operation, and fuel was at a premium in the desert. Shipping sacks of dark, heavy concentrate back to the valley would have reduced the danger of theft en route. And it's also a very complicated operation. This is what you have to do to get gold out of this kind of ore. We've seen the preliminary crushing and washing out. The next step is to roast that concentrate to drive off the sulfur and the arsenic. You crush that again and heat it up with lead. We tested a minuscule sample of this concentrate at a very large physical facility and found not only gold, but lead in this ore. This is a good thing. If you don't have lead, you have to add it. Because you put your concentrate with lead, heat it up to red-hot heat, and the lead slag runs off and you're left with a cake of lead. You take that cake of lead and put it in a porous cupellation vessel or brick dust or sand, anything porous, and heat that up again until the lead oxidizes and seeps into the sand or the cupellation vessel, and you're left with little beads of gold or silver or electrum on top. If you want to purify that, you take those little beads and put them in a cementation vessel with salt and a flux like silica. Heat that up for 5 days until it stops smoking, and that silver salts penetrate the wall of the vessel and you're left with refined gold. If you want to recover the silver, you can crunch up that vessel and repeat the smelting with lead and get refined silver. So this is a very poisonous, fuel-intensive, technically complicated operation. How long was Virumfawa here occupied? We have basically pottery dates, but we can, in three cases, see three levels of occupation. So it looks as if it was occupied, abandoned, and reoccupied as the need for gold became extremely demanding and the resources were available. In this case, you have the upper kitchen level, all this ash, fill and this burning place on the second level, and then your quote-unquote cheese factory in this windblown silt on the bottom. When was Birumfawa here abandoned? Again, we don't know exactly. Probably the end of the 6th century. First of all, after 150, 170 years of intermittent but intensive activity, the gold was probably mined out. All the easy stuff was gone. The empire at this point was under threat on many frontiers, so the resources, men, and grain would have been urgently needed elsewhere, no matter how pressing the need for gold. And then the plague started to hit, which would have further reduced the resources available for mining in the deep desert. So when the miners left, we really have no record of any activity at this site for centuries until the end of the 19th century, when the geologists started coming through, followed by the miners at the beginning of the 20th century, and finally by the archaeologists. So I'm going to now ask a favor of the audience. Please hold your questions until after the session, and I will be very happy to answer them then. Thank you.